My name is Karen Erickson, and I'm a member of First Presbyterian Church. And spontaneously, I was asked to do the introduction because speaking today is my coworker, Christopher Martinez. We both work at Catholic Charities, CYO, in San Francisco, where we're the social service arm of the Catholic Church for the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And I have run homelessness prevention programs there, as well as now I'm doing all our assessment and learning. But I've had the privilege of working with Christopher for the past 8 years, and I did read over his bio when it got sent. I was like, wow. I mean, I knew he was great, but he's been doing this program for 16 years, so you've got a really solid expert. He does a lot of, he runs all of our immigration services as well as our refugee resettlement services. Born in Guatemala, he immigrated to the United States as a small child. He was raised in a home of first-generation immigrants, and he's always felt a calling to give back to the immigrant community that helped raise him. In his clients, he sees members of his own family, and it gives him great joy to serve them. And I can testify to that, as I've seen. And I'll just, maybe I'll let you talk a little bit more if you'd like about yourself, but he's really a great advocate on behalf of those new to our country, and you'll really enjoy learning from him. So thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
And this one is mine, so you don't have to.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much, and I've got my coffee here to also help keep me going. Thank you so much, Karen and Bridget, so much for the invite and for the introduction. And I'm humbled because, of course, you know, I feel my parents made a great sacrifice coming to this country to give myself and my sister a better life. I don't know what my life would have been like living in Guatemala. I visited the country. I still have lots of family there. But it's very poor. All my family is very, very poor. And there's a lot of political problems, and there's still a lot of problems in that country. And so I thank my parents for doing what they did, which is a huge sacrifice to leave your homeland, come to a place where they didn't speak English, they had no job skills. Both my parents worked in factories. I think that's part of the reason why my mom and dad are very sick now. They're in their late 60s, early 70s, and they're both suffering lots of health problems. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that they were working in pretty intense factories. My mom actually worked at a meatpacking factory, so she was in the freezer for the better part of her working career, and finally had to give it up. And so she's now at home. They're both retired, and I was sharing with Bridget that they're living in a nice, comfortable retirement community along the lake in Chicago, Illinois. That's where I grew up, and it's cold. Yeah, it's cold. It's hot. It's a city of extreme temperatures, so you can't win either way. But it's a beautiful city. It is a beautiful city. But I love living in San Francisco, although I don't live there anymore. But I do love being in the Bay Area. I think it's just a diverse and rich area, also filled with many, many immigrant communities. It's what helps make it diverse and rich. And so I'm very happy to share what I know. And I send the bio because that's what people ask. But I mean, it's like I said, I thank you, Karen, for saying I'm the expert. But there's always so much more to learn. There's always so much more that is immigration laws are changing. Refugees are constantly on the move. And so it's very hard for me to keep up with everything. I do my best, but it's hard being on the ground trying to provide the services for the people that are here. So it's sometimes difficult for me to keep up with what's going on in the world. So I hope I do it justice, and you know, forgive me if I don't know something. I definitely can find out for you. But I did learn something over the weekend that I could share with you about Bhutanese refugees, which is a new population of refugees that are arriving in the United States, and we could talk about that in a little bit. So, and you welcomed me. Migration, refugee resettlement, and our services is basically the topic for today. And I think I have a clock there, so I don't have to whip out my cell phone to monitor my time. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to share with you a little bit about why people come to the U.S., and perhaps maybe engage you in a conversation about why you think people come to the U.S. Why do people migrate? Why are people constantly on the move? What is the plight of refugees today? And a little bit about what we offer, what our services are able to offer when the refugees and the immigrants arrive to the United States. And then I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. And again, as I said, if I don't know the answer, I know where to find it, and I can definitely get back to you on it. And then we can just hopefully have a nice conversation this morning. Okay. I know you're familiar with this Bible passage. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. A stranger and you welcomed me. That is kind of our motto or our mission or our raison d'etre for our program, is to really welcome the stranger in our community. I thought we could start by saying a little prayer. Would that be okay? All right. If we could all just, can you all see? Because it's a little, maybe the lights are a little too bright. It's good? Okay. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of all creation. Through your goodness, we live in this land that you have so richly blessed. Help us always to recognize our blessings come from you, and remind us to share them with others, especially those who come to us today from other lands. Help us to be generous, just, and welcoming, as you have been and are generous to us. Thank you very much. After reading that, and what I would like for you to think about as we talk today, these are a couple of questions of reflection. We may not be able to get to them depending on time, but I would love for us to be able to talk about this a little bit at the end. So if you could take a look at it, and I apologize, I realized I didn't bring any handouts, but we'll see the questions again at the end of the session. In the Eucharistic prayer, it talks about the fruit of the vine and the work of human hands. I want you to think about that statement as we progress and we start talking about what we're talking about this morning, to see how you see the Eucharist and how you see the receiving of the body of Christ, how you see that as part of the immigrant journey, of the immigrant experience, and really the fruit of the vine and work of human hands, how that really plays into the Eucharistic prayer. And so we'll revisit this at the end of the session. But I just wanted you to look at them and think about it as we're talking. So why do we migrate? Why do people move from place to place? I think it's something that is pretty much part of being human. We move from place to place because we're always searching for something better. I migrated from Chicago because I could not deal with another Chicago winter. That's the reality. And my parents, as I said before, migrated from Guatemala to escape some pretty harsh economic conditions there to give their children a better life. People are always migrating for better jobs, better schools. We all migrate. It's just part of being human. And our ancestors, of course, would migrate when the food would run out or when places would become barren or the weather would get too extreme. They would move to someplace else. It's just part of human survival. So it really is part of being human. And with that, they bring with them traditions and culture. It's what helped really form what we see our culture look like today. It's rich in diversity and it's rich in culture because of the experiences that immigrants and refugees bring to us. And of course, if you are a person of faith, no matter what faith you are, you could be Christian or Muslim or Hindu, it doesn't matter what faith tradition you believe in, I believe that every faith tradition has something in its teachings about welcoming the stranger, hospitality, making sure that the stranger among you is welcomed, because as mentioned in the Bible at least, you were once a stranger in the land of Egypt. And of course, our most famous refugee family is the Holy Family, Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. They were living in exile, fleeing persecution. There are five principles that emanate from these church teachings, and we'll go over them really quickly. That the first one is the persons have the right to find opportunities in their homeland. I think that's also something that gets left out often of the immigration debate, and I know many of you are aware of what's going on right now with the comprehensive immigration reform debates. What do we do with the people that are here? How do we protect our borders? It's a constant debate. It's a debate that's been going on for many, many decades. But sometimes what gets left out of the conversation is, why do people come here? They come here because they can't find opportunities in their homeland. They're fleeing persecution. They're fleeing economic, political, religious, racial persecution in their homelands. And so they're seeking something better. And as we said before, no one is going to live in an environment of adversity. They're going to move to some place where they're welcomed, where they have opportunities. But they should be given a right to opportunities in their homeland. And so we, especially as a society that's advanced and has wealth and has resources, we should be looking at how we can help the conditions in other countries so that people don't have to come here. I think if given a choice, perhaps my parents would have stayed. I wouldn't have had the pleasure of meeting all of you. I would have grown up in Guatemala. But I would be okay with that because I think my parents deserved a chance to stay in Guatemala and live a life there. And as I said, I have lots of family there, so it's family I don't really know. But if given a chance, they would have stayed. At the same time, as I said before, persons have the right to migrate to better support themselves and their family, and that's what they did, and that's what we've talked about. But also, sovereign nations do have the right to control their borders. Someone once asked me, Christopher, what would it take what would happen if you were out of work? What would it take to basically end the need for immigration services, for social services, for this type of work that I do? And the only answer I could come up with was open borders. If we lived in a world of open borders where no one was judged or viewed upon by their culture or color or skin or religion, or if we were just all free, I think there would be no need for me, because there would be no need for immigration. Everybody could just freely go wherever they chose to. But as long as sovereign nations have borders and sovereign nations have ways to they control people coming in and leaving, then you're going to need someone like myself or an immigration attorney or someone who could help guide them through this process, because it is a very bureaucratic, very complicated process. But they do. As long as we have that, then we do acknowledge that sovereign nations do have the right to control their borders. But what's missing out of this little blurb here, and we'll talk about in more detail, is that but they must do it in a just and compassionate way. So I think what we're looking at now is the militarization of our border, and that's not just or compassionate. At the same time, there's reasons why that's happening, so we could talk about that. But we definitely want to make sure that it's done in a way that's humane and respecting the dignity of everyone. Refugees and asylum seekers should be afforded protection. So we're going to talk a lot about refugees this morning and asylum seekers, why people flee. So my parents were not refugees, although you could argue that they were economic refugees. That still isn't a title or a term of refugee persecution that's allowed in immigration or refugee policy. But that's what they were, for all intents and purposes. But refugees who flee and asylum seekers who flee on persecution on the basis of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a social group should be afforded protection. I don't know how many of you have ever visited a refugee camp or who have ever visited a detention facility here in the United States, but when someone has fled persecution, they're forced to live in a refugee camp. These camps tend to be very horrible. The conditions there are very horrible. And sometimes thousands of people are cramped into a space that really should only accommodate a few hundred. And so it's a horrible way to live, and many of them are stuck there for decades because they can't go back home and they have nowhere else to go. So you have children born and raised in a refugee camp. Similarly, when people come fleeing their homelands based on the basis of persecution coming to the United States, oftentimes when they're greeted at the airport or whatever port of entry they come to, they will be immediately taken to a detention facility because they don't have a right to come in. They don't have a legal immigration avenue to come in. You could seek political asylum, but you have to first go before a judge and present your case. And right now, many of the people that are seeking asylum are placed in essentially prisons. And they're placed in prisons with other people who've committed crimes, who've committed pretty horrible, violent crimes. And the only crime that these people have committed is that they violated our immigration laws. which isn't a criminal offense, it's a civil offense. So there has to be another way. There has to be an alternative to detaining asylum seekers in the U.S., and we could talk about that a little bit more. And lastly, the human dignity and human rights of the undocumented migrant should be respected and should be recognized. And at the end, you'll see what I mean. No matter what faith tradition you are, I believe we can all agree that we're all God's children. No matter, I don't think God would have an immigration policy. And so everyone should be treated with respect and dignity, regardless of where they come from, regardless of the color of their skin, or just regardless of their economic status. We're all still children of God. And also, I wanted to ask you, if any of you have any questions or things you want clarified or comments, I know we have a question and answer session at the end, but I like to engage people as I'm talking. So please just raise your hand and we'll stop and we'll talk. Okay. I want to share with you three stories of refugees and immigrants that I know, that are very close to me. Francisco fled Cuba in 1995. Because he was involved in the Christian democracy movement. He won political asylum in Puerto Rico and was resettled by Catholic Charities in Miami. So Catholic Charities is a huge network of agencies, and we do similar work. And he later moved to San Francisco, and now he works with immigrants and has found a chance to give back. The way he was helped as essentially a refugee coming into the U.S., now he's able to help. Diana left Colombia in 1999 and came to the U.S. also seeking political asylum. She was persecuted. As a journalist, her safety was compromised. Her country was ravaged in guerrilla warfare. She won her political asylum in 2000, and she's deeply religious. She's a devout Catholic, and now she's also working to help and give back a little bit of what she was given when she first came to the U.S. Chris was born in Guatemala in 1968. His parents came to the U.S. in 1970. It took 4 years for Chris's visa to be available so that he could be reunited with his parents. So for those 4 years, Chris and his mother were separated. His mother missed all the, you know, the firsts, first steps, first words, all those things. It's because of a backlog in immigration. That's the reason why the visa took 4 years. But now he works hard to advocate for immigrants. I know I always do this, and I feel like, oh, I'm shocking everybody. They don't know who these people are. I'm sure you figured it out. Chris is me. And Francisco and Diana are my coworkers. So these are my staff. This is who works in my program. And we have three other people that work in our program that are not immigrants, but they're children of immigrants, or they've lived with immigrants, or they've studied with immigrants, or they've had the pleasure of working with people of different cultures. And so when we say we walk the talk, or what is it, walk the walk or whatever, we've lived that journey of the refugee and immigrant experience. And so we are very proud to share our experiences and to be able to advocate for people who are coming after us. So these are some of the languages we speak. Right now, we used to speak 10 different languages. But I say that with a little bit of sadness, because 10 languages meant 7 of them were spoken by one person. Pat was amazing. She spoke 7 different languages, and unfortunately she left our agency, so we went down to 2, English and Spanish. But now we've gotten a new staff person who speaks Mandarin and Spanish and Portuguese and German. She's actually right now in Vermont at a Chinese immersion program for 2 months. She'll be immersed in Mandarin. And so I think that's wonderful. I think it's wonderful when someone can learn a second, because she's U.S. born. She's a U.S. born citizen who learned Spanish, who learned Mandarin, who learned Portuguese, and has really become one of my greatest, newest employees. So I'm very happy to have her. But we have different nationalities that we represent, different people born from different countries. So as I said before, we're giving back. This is our way of giving back. Now, our clients are predominantly Latin American. They mostly come from Latin America. 10% are from Asia or Pacific Islander. 6% European or FSU, which is former Soviet Union countries. 3% African, 3% Middle Eastern. Those numbers are on the rise. And you'll see in a moment, because the Latino, Asian, and European mostly represent immigrants. The African and Middle Eastern are representing the refugee population. And so we'll talk about that next. Really quickly, I wanted to let you know what we provide in for, as far as legal immigration services. We do, all our services are provided by Board of Immigration Appeals accredited representatives. We have no lawyers on staff, although that might change because we interviewed two people and they were awesome, but anyway. But we're all Board of Immigration Appeals representatives, which means that we go through training and we get accredited by the Department of Justice to be able to provide legal immigration services. The reason that's important is that we're under the heavy scrutiny of the Department of Justice to make sure that whatever casework we provide or we do is good. We are not notarios. We are not unscrupulous practitioners who are in it just for the money. There are some really good immigration lawyers out there. There are also some really bad ones. And there are many bad notarios. And these people, all they do is take the immigrants' money and put them in problems. They'll file phony claims just to get them a green card, and then they'll be put in proceedings afterwards. A notario is a private individual that runs his or her own business, providing different types of services, taxes, real estate. They're notary publics, so they have the notary public stamp. Financial planning, all types of services, legal services, but they're not lawyers. They're not trained or licensed attorneys, but yet they're providing legal services to the community. And what happens is that the services are pretty subpar, and the other problem is that a lot of people, especially from Latin America, the word notario in Latin America means attorney, so they exploit that. They take advantage of that. They see that these people know, and especially if you're coming from very low educational backgrounds or things like that, you know, they'll see that people they can take advantage of people that way. So we're very heavily involved in trying to advocate to the community, stay away from notarios. Notarios are they could do the stamp; they're good for notary public, but please don't go to them for immigration services. But try as we do, people still do it. So we have our work cut out for us, but all our staff are Board of Immigration Appeals accredited representatives. We do general consultations and referral if we can't see the case or the case is too complex, or there's cases that we won't take because of their complexity. We'll refer them out to immigration attorneys. Citizenship, green card applications, what's called adjustment of status, family petitions, helping people reunite. Deferred action. Some of you were talking a little bit about young people getting driver's licenses now, that's what that is. The deferred action for childhood arrivals was a policy that was passed a year ago, giving those children that were brought to the U.S. Those young people that were brought to the U.S. as children, the opportunity to get a work permit. Yes, sir.
How do people that would be needing
services actually find them? Word of mouth is huge. Word of mouth is definitely huge. Clients refer their families, their friends, in their communities, churches. We get a lot of referrals from parishes or different churches. We really don't do a lot of advertising. It's a lot of word of mouth. We used to do some outreach, but we found that it's not necessary. And in fact, it would be a little bit not very responsible of us to do a lot of outreach because right now it's only a staff of five. And the need is so huge. And so we don't want people to come and all of a sudden be told they have to wait. We want to be able to serve them. So, but with immigration reform happening maybe, we're looking at those numbers increasing. And so we're definitely needing to do some planning right now of how we're going to meet that need. But right now it's pretty much word of mouth and through churches. Okay. Work permits. Especially that's for people who are here on temporary protected status or are seeking asylum. They're able to get a work permit. We'll help people replace lost documents. You would be amazed how many people come to us and say, I lost my green card. Wow. It's like you lost such an important document. But, you know, it happens. People get robbed. People I don't know how many times I've left my phone. It happens. People are human. You know. FOIA. Freedom of Information Act requests. People don't realize that these are public records, and so you have a right to ask the government for your record. And so we could do a Freedom of Information Act request to get the entire immigration file. VAWA self-petitions and U and T visas are for victims of domestic violence and victims of human trafficking or violent crimes. We'll talk a little bit more about that later if time allows. Okay, really quickly, I wanted to show you this chart. Because I love this chart because sometimes, especially now that the debate is really heating up, people ask me or people say, well, you know, I'm for immigration reform, I'm for the immigrant, but I just can't get past the whole violating our laws, you know, coming here illegally. I just can't get past that. They really should do it the legal way. They should do it the way everyone else has done it. The way my ancestors did it, the way my grandparents did it. And I would say to them, absolutely, you're absolutely right. But let's look at this chart, because what this chart represents is that this chart represents the visa backlog. When people file for a family petition to bring their relatives to the U.S., they apply for a visa, essentially, for their relative. You're given a date. The date is called your priority date. When your priority date becomes current or becomes available, that means a visa is available, and you can at that point immediately file for your relatives to join you here. Remember I shared with you my story, it took 4 years for my visa? That's because for my category, where I was a child of a resident, because my mom did have a green card. The child of a resident took 4 years for the visa to become available. So there is still a bit of a wait. So in some cases, the waits are not that long. If we look at, category 2A, green card holders, so if they're petitioning their children under the age of 18 or their spouses, looks like pretty much they're processing applications that are given a priority date of 2011. So that means if you filed an application in, say, October 8th of 2011, your visa is available now in July. This is the July visa bulletin. That means that you can file the petition and bring them here. So it's about a 2-year wait. Not too bad. That's not that bad. If you're a child over the age of 21, 2005 is looking like, if you're from, say, China, November 1st, 2005. So it's about a 8-year wait. So now it's getting a little bit longer. But let's look at something pretty horrible. Let's look at if you're from Mexico and you're petitioning your brother or sister. Fourth preference, Mexico. September 22nd, 1996. So that's, I can't do my math right now. That's 17 years. What about the Philippines? 15th of December, 1989. Now we're looking at a 24-year wait. So this is what I share with people. I share with people that, yes, people are they're trying to do it the legal way, the right way. But if you have backlogs like this, then you wonder why people come here in the way they do. People come with visas and overstay. That's another myth, by the way. People think that, you know, we just have droves of people coming across the border. It's a very dangerous border to cross. I've been there. People come with a visa. They just don't go back. They overstay on their visa. But this is the reason why. So part of the immigration reform debate now is to fix this backlog, to make sure that everybody that's already waiting for a family petition is moved along more quickly. Because 24 years, I actually had a client who came to see me, and she said, and we told her, your visa's available now. And she said, thank you, Christopher, but my sister's already dead. She already died 2 years ago. So she never was able to reunite with her sister from the Philippines. So, and the reason why China, India, Mexico, and the Philippines are kind of singled out is that these are the countries with the highest immigration rates. So, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, compared to the population, 10 to 50 times more than what's the legal quota.
Right. That's true.
That's another pressure. People make that comparison all the time. It's a very unfair comparison.
Right. That's true. No, you're absolutely right in that. You know, now can we? We're looking at a backlog of over 200. I believe it's 250,000 visa applicants. Our population has ballooned since the turn of the century, the previous century. And so, yeah, do we have the resources to welcome all these newcomers? Do we have the jobs, the housing, the schools? It's definitely something that shouldn't be excluded from the debate, but I appreciate you saying that because you know it's I make the comparison just to say that this is what it looks like now. So people just have it in when they're talking about it, they realize this is the problem. The problem is that the backlog is really high. But you're right. The reason the backlog is high is because there's more people applying.
Well, it's also because the quota has shrunk so much. I mean,
that's true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Every decade between like the Civil War and World War II.
Right.
Now, people worried about the growth in the Latino population in the United States. I mean, 10% per decade, you know, might be, you know, an upper bound on the rate of total immigration, but the rate of legal immigration is much lower than that because it's much smaller quota.
Right.
So
right. Right, right. That's true. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay. Let me move on to talking about what is a refugee, asylee, and immigrant. The differences between the three. I think I spoke a little bit about this in the beginning. A refugee is somebody that flees persecution. They're fleeing persecution. They're identified overseas, usually in a camp or in a place of exile. And they are brought to the U.S. They're actually invited to come to the U.S. And we'll go over the numbers and the process in a little bit. An asylum seeker, an asylee, is somebody that comes to U.S. soil, is fleeing the same persecution, but they found a way to actually come to the U.S. So they're seeking asylum in the United States. And an immigrant is somebody who comes here voluntarily in most cases for a variety of reasons, including work, study, reunification with family, or as a result of fleeing economic persecution. That's why I wrote it out at the bottom, can be considered involuntarily because, again, as I said before, if people have opportunities in their homeland, they may not decide to come here, but they come here because they have to put food on the table. So those are the differences. A refugee doesn't have a choice in fleeing. They're fleeing because they're fleeing for their lives. Asylum seeker, same thing. An immigrant doesn't always face that level of persecution, but sometimes they do, in which case if they come here seeking asylum, then they're an asylee. But if they come here seeking economic opportunities, then they wouldn't be considered a refugee or asylum. They're considered an immigrant. They come to the U.S., so refugees, let's talk about refugees. Refugees come to the U.S. because they're fleeing persecution. They survived unimaginable trauma. The refugees that I've worked with, they share their stories with me, and it just absolutely breaks my heart. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. So just imagine for a moment if you were asked, if you had to think about these questions, if you were asked to think about you flee your homeland, what that would look like. You were given hours notice. I had a family from Iraq who was given, they were given a note saying, leave the country tonight, otherwise we're going to kill you, your entire family. So they left. They had 4 hours, I think, just to gather their immediate belongings. They couldn't even find their passport, so they just left. They went to Jordan. You survive. So then they went to Jordan. They're surviving, but they're not thriving. the Jordan government doesn't welcome Iraqi refugees very well, and so they were living in exile. He had to bribe local officials to let his daughters go to school as soon as they found out they were from Iraq. You don't know what your future holds. They were there 4 years and always wondering what was going to happen to their lives, to their family. You struggle. As I said, he had to bribe local officials to let his daughters go to school. He couldn't find work because there's horrible discrimination against Iraqis in Jordan. They were struggling. You're offered an opportunity. You're told that your case was approved. You actually are a refugee. The United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees says you are a refugee. You will be settled in another country. So you're given an opportunity now to leave Jordan, but unfortunately you can never go back to Iraq. So that's hard. That's hard to take when you know you can't go back to where what your home was. Oops. There we go. You were told that you will be going to California. Well, at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger was our governor, so they were kind of excited about it. But they didn't realize what they were in for. California, sun. I had the same misconception. I said, I'm leaving Chicago because I need the sun. I go to San Francisco. So you don't know. You don't know what to expect. You're just worried about what's awaiting us there. But at the same time, you hope. You hope for a better future. You can't go back to Iraq. They couldn't go back to Iraq. They couldn't go back to Jordan. They didn't want to stay in Jordan. So California, United States is offering them a new opportunity. Let's see what happened to this family. I'll share you their story in a second. They're actually one of my favorite families because they shared me a really powerful story, so I'll share that with you. So really quickly, I wanted to explain to you how the process works. It's a really complex process, and I have trouble at the DMV, so I have no idea how people deal with all of this bureaucracy. But overseas, at either a refugee camp or at a embassy, or just it's called an overseas processing entity. That is where they're given their status. They have to plead their case. They actually essentially have to file for asylum by themselves before an officer, an immigration officer or a Department of State officer, and say why they can't go back to their homeland. And if they're given that status, then they're actually given the status of refugee at that level. They still have to go through an interview with the Department of Homeland Security. This is actually something new. Something more recent, especially after 9/11, this has been significantly increased. This interview is very intense, and this is where they will do all of the security background checks and make sure that this person isn't coming from a terrorist organization, et cetera, et cetera. So the Department of Homeland Security interview is a very intense interview. In many, many, many cases, individuals are denied. They're denied their refugee status. So they have to reappeal. There is a motion to reconsider. They will just go back through the same process. Thankfully, in many cases, they will win their case. If they're approved, then great. But then they become one of the estimated 14 million approved refugees in the world. There's 14 million people that are displaced worldwide. We can't possibly begin to help them all. There's just no way. We're trying. I think a lot of countries and organizations, churches, people care and want to help. But it's 14 million people. I just don't, it's the size of a country. I don't know how we're going to help them all. And the United States right now is the largest resettler of refugees in the entire world. And our cap right now, our quota, is 70,000. 70,000 is the maximum we will accept per year. Canada would be our next largest resettler, but I think they're only up to like 25,000. And then Australia, I think Australia is 15,000. So you kind of have to ask, what are these other countries? Great Britain, France, although France has its own problems with immigration right now. But what are these other countries doing? 14 million people is a lot of people. But again, we should be looking at maybe ways that maybe they can go back home. Maybe there's ways we can fix their country so they can go back home, so they don't have to go to another country. But in cases where they absolutely cannot go back, they need to go somewhere. Living in those camps is absolutely horrendous. And so we want to get them somewhere. Once they're approved, they go through a medical screening, a sponsorship assurance, which just basically means that they find out that there's someone in the U.S. that will help them, whether it's a family, a church, or an organization. That's the sponsorship assurance. And then the cultural orientation, they're given a cultural orientation overseas. I have criticisms about this cultural orientation because sometimes they promise things that we can't deliver. I had one refugee who said, "Where's my computer?" And I said, "Who told you you were getting a computer?" He said, "At the cultural orientation, they told me I was getting a brand new laptop." I said, "Whoa." I said, "Let me find out. Let me see if I can get a donation somewhere." But we were lucky. We were able to get a donated computer. But brand new? No. I mean, that's not possible. Unless, you know, these are things that come up in conversation with the refugees, and I say to myself, okay, I need to work harder to build up resources and try to find resources in the community. Maybe contact Google and see if they can donate 100 computers so that I have them for refugees. So that's still in the works. They travel to the U.S., and then they are offered resettlement services when they get here. And that's where we come in. And actually, that's where all of you come in. Because when refugees arrive, they need our help. They need our help to resettle in their new country. After having gone through all the unimaginable trauma that we talked about, now they're here, and they need our help. And so what can we do for them? So this is what part of what we do for them. As a resettlement office, we're actually called the sponsor. So even though we work with family members, our agency is 100% responsible for the new arrival. We either meet them or arrange for pickup at the airport. There was a time where we used to welcome them with little welcome baskets, a basket of basic needs, essentials, toiletries. And welcome with a huge banner saying welcome to the U.S. or in their language, we'll say it in their language. That was nice. But as resources started to dwindle and staffing, unfortunately our staffing has just been shrunk because of budget cuts, we're not able to do that anymore. But the family members, we'll make sure we arrange with the family members here to go pick them up at the airport. And then we'll do the big celebration when they come to our office. That's kind of the second best thing we can do. We arrange for housing, either through the family reunification or free case. Free case, what that means is that the family is not able to help them or they have no family here. If they have no family here, then it's an even greater challenge because you're providing every possible service to this new family. But sometimes, even if their family's here, the family doesn't want to help them. So you wind up helping them as if though they were a free case. Housing right now is our biggest challenge. I shared with Bridget, now I'm living in Fairfield. I'm paying for a huge house. I'm paying $500 less in rent. There's no way a refugee family newly arrived with no skills, no English, and not working is able to afford any apartment in San Francisco. And so we're looking at other places where they can go. Unfortunately, the services that they need are in San Francisco, the following services. We prepare a resettlement plan with them. We link them up with the government services that are available. Health services, public and community services, we make sure that we enroll their children in school. We take them to the Social Security office. I actually take them to the Social Security office because in many cases, the Social Security office workers don't know what a refugee is. And so they will ask me, well, where's their passport? As I told you before, my Iraqi family did not have even a chance to pick up their passport. But they had their Department of State letter that says they're a refugee. That's enough. But the Social Security office didn't want to take that at first. They said they need their passport. And I said, so you're saying that the Secretary of State that signed this letter is not a valid signer of this letter? This is an official document. Please take this to your supervisor. She did. The supervisor agreed, and they got their Social Security cards. But it took that level of advocacy to be able to get them something that they deserve, which is a Social Security number. That they need, in our culture, they need a Social Security number. We refer them to ESL and employment agencies. We used to offer ESL on site, which was a wonderful experience. We would have different people from different countries all learning English. It was just a wonderful service. But again, due to budget cuts, we're not providing that anymore. So we partner with other agencies that do. Maybe some of you have heard of Refugee Transitions. They provide ESL classes. Some of the local city colleges will do city classes, ESL classes for refugee clients specifically. English is something that they want to learn because they know that that'll mean some economic success for them. It'll mean economic advancement. It also just means that they'll be able to adjust to their new culture by learning English. Vocational programs, school. We've enrolled refugees in nursing school or to study to be home health aides or to study to be CNAs. So we've helped refugees really link up with vocational programs. And then volunteers, and this is where all of you come in. If you know of a refugee family or refugees coming in your area and you want to help, every agency that resettles refugees needs volunteers. We honestly cannot do it without the support of volunteers. Volunteers are a godsend. Yes. 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 It has. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, in this last budget, I think it was also cut. So we have to find alternatives. And like I said, I really look to churches to help fill that gap because I know there's some really talented people, persons of faith, and they could. You know, we've talked to a couple of parishes who are interested in starting like their own little ESL class. You know, just impromptu. Just invite them to come in on a Sunday to learn English at their church. It can be done. But you're right. The ESL programs and adult schools have been decimated.
And they were tiered, you know, from beginner to highly advanced so that people could progress.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm monitoring my time, so I want to move through this a little more quickly. But this is just to give you an idea of the where refugees are coming from. I have a much more extensive chart later, but we'll skip that. But this gives you an overview. As I said before, right now the U.S. is accepting 70,000. But because of those extensive background and security checks, sometimes we don't meet our goal. So if you see in 2011, we actually did not meet our goal. We said 70,000, but the total that actually arrived was 56,000. So it's still a very bureaucratic process, and it could also be that we don't have a site to send them to. So there's a lot of factors that come into play why we don't meet our goal. Our goal is 70, and what we in the refugee community or the refugee services community would like to see is we actually would like to see us exceed our goal. Not meet our goal is actually not acceptable. Exceeding our goal would be good. We didn't meet it in 2012 either. In 2012, the government does have a little difficulty gathering. Before this presentation, I tried to get data current. I wasn't able to, so I apologize. This is the most current data I was able to find. 2012, we only reached 58,000. Yes, sir. I would say probably the number one factor is the Department of Homeland Security interview. That's where, as I said before, that's where a lot of cases get denied. So then they have to go back through the process again, and then sometimes that process can take a year or more to be able to present their case again, have another interview, and then be given an opportunity to travel. Yes, sir. Well, we don't. We in San Francisco, we don't, because of the high cost of housing and lack of low-skilled work. There are other parts of the country that have more opportunities. So that's interesting. You mentioned that because I remember a family also from Iraq wanted to come to San Francisco, but they did not have relatives to support them. They wanted to go as a free case, and I had to reject them because I said I don't have an apartment for you. You're going to come to San Francisco and be homeless, which is horrible. So we found them a site in Rockford, Illinois, which is not too far from Chicago. I was all excited. I said, Rockford, hey, I know where Rockford is. It's a beautiful community. I go online. At that particular moment, Rockford was experiencing a surge in crime. I don't know why, but it was. And so they found out that they're tech savvy. They went on Google, they looked it up, and they're like, Rockford is a very high crime area. And I said, you know what? it's kind of a fluke. I don't know what's going on right now, but Rockford is actually a really nice community. I said, you'll be fine there. You have to start somewhere. Go there and build your resources, start working, save your money. And then once you have something that you can use, then you can come to the Bay Area. But please don't come here because, you know, and I told him what an apartment costs in San Francisco, and they weren't going to make it. So you're right. There are other parts of the country that do resettle refugees that have greater resources. Right now, I think the largest Somali refugee population of refugees is in Kentucky, in Louisville, Kentucky. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And what the quotas are. And it just seems, you know, it's a matter of survival that can get here. It just seems like to have that many people coming from Africa, and I'm not even clear what you're saying, like that, what that is. It just seems weird that you, like, are the other countries considered to have more high-risk people?
Yes. And you know, thank you very much for asking that question, because I was hoping someone would ask me that question. So these numbers are there's an incredibly complicated formula that goes into preparing these numbers that I have yet to decipher. I think it is based a lot on the level of persecution and the level of fear that's whatever's happening in that region. Although I think we could pretty much argue that Africa is right now, and I would say at the height. So I don't know why the African number is so low. Near East and South Asia, as I said before, remember I talked a little bit about the people from Bhutan? Right now that is our crisis, people from Bhutan. Many of them have been in refugee camps in Nepal and India for about 20 years. And so I think the U.S. especially is making decisions based on, okay, the height of danger might be the highest in Africa right now, but we have families that have been living in camps for the last 20 years in Nepal. So the 31,000, most of them are from Bhutan, or formerly from Bhutan, that are living in exile in Nepal and India.
But I guess I was wondering, like, their cultures where they are so extremely different than what they're going to have when they get here.
Yes.
That, you know.
Well, then that's where the communities, the schools, the local governments, the churches really do play a huge role in how they welcome these people to come here. And in a minute, I'll show you a picture of something that happened recently in Oakland, actually, a huge refugee sort of celebration of all the diversity and culture that they bring and everyone local that wants to help. It was just a nice welcome. It was just a picnic in the park, basically. But it was just a nice way for people to say, look, you're welcomed here. When we, in San Francisco, when we had a large number of refugees arrive, we did something in our office called, it was a multicultural Thanksgiving. So we provided the traditional American fixins, like turkey and mashed potatoes and those kind of items. And we invited the refugees to bring foods from their own culture. So we had this huge buffet table of food from all over the world. With little flags and little descriptions of what the food were. And I don't know, if Karen, if you enjoyed one of those meals with us or not, but it was everyone loved to experience that, because again, it allowed the refugees to feel welcomed, because we were asking them to bring their culture and their foods to our table. And at the same time, we provided them something which was pretty, you know, Thanksgiving is kind of a very American holiday. And so we were able to give them something that was really American, that they felt very, very proud to receive. Yes? Yes. That's exactly
that.
Right. But then it goes back to what this gentleman said, that if all of a sudden, if that community is tapped out, then they may not. They may have to send them somewhere else. And so that's, yeah, I think for the Iraqis, they started to resettle in Iowa, in Des Moines. But Des Moines started to tap out, and so they had to find somewhere else. And so right now, San Jose was a big resettler of Iraqi refugees. And so, yeah, they have to also watch out for that. There was a challenge case where I think it was Arlington, Virginia, where they resettled. They welcomed hundreds of Somali refugees. The community was not prepared. The schools were not prepared. The housing was not ready. The community itself wasn't ready to receive all of these newcomers. And there were some problems. There were some problems. There was some racism and, just anti-discrimination and things like that. So lesson learned, you don't want to welcome refugees to a new place unless the community is ready for them. You know, I think you had a question. Right. Right, right. It's like Bridget said, they do try their best to place people where there's existing communities. That's very important. But if those communities are not able to accept more, then they have to start somewhere else. And so they'll generally do what every year I'm asked to do an assessment of our own capabilities. And I send it back to Washington, our national office in Washington, to say, what is our capacity? I have to actually consult with our local government and ask them, can we, are we okay in accepting this number of refugees for this next year? I have to get their approval first before I can actually proceed. I think in San Francisco, I feel lucky because it's such a diverse and rich city, but it's also a very expensive city. And so we don't resettle a lot of refugees in San Francisco for that reason. Those things have to be thought about before the refugees arrive, because the worst thing that can happen is they'll get here and everything just falls apart. Yes, ma'am.
The school district did not seem to be as far as these people are going to be allowed to settle here, or was that all private family connections and not federal government?
No, it would be every community should have a forum or network of providers that meets regularly. I don't think that's the thing. I don't think they include the school district. I'm really happy you're at, because all these questions are so related. It's like, what happens? You were unprepared. And so I think that was a failure of the refugee services network to properly consult with you prior to their arrival. But that's essentially what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to. You're right. At least just give you a heads up, and I think that that's important, because if all of a sudden you have this influx of new refugees from a culture that you're not used to working with, or they're new, you just want to be given a chance to at least be prepared. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a little African community somewhere around the Telegraph Avenue area, mm-hmm. Now, because I see the women on the buses,
yeah,
their clothing and stuff, and there's a little group of stores there, where they can get their spices and stuff, their African food.
Right.
And there's probably a little one up somewhere, like around Brooklyn, because there's little African stores up there, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're so tiny.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's no growth in that area. Where there is growth in that area, it's like commercialized redevelopment. So they're not going to get in there either. So
yes.
Maybe there's a way of advocating for, so people can, because people would assimilate, I would assume, a lot easier if they could be in places, or at least you have somebody to talk to.
Right, right.
Because you can't, like green, I guess that's what I'm looking at. If you bring
vicinity. Right. So that's, right. You know, yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly, exactly. Well, let's jump ahead. Let's talk about these challenges, because this is I appreciate this conversation, because I'm struggling right now just in San Francisco to see how we can serve more refugees, given the fact that our housing costs are just skyrocketing. But I think that what happened where she wasn't consulted, there wasn't a community gathering of sorts or method to be able to talk about this before the refugees arrive. I think that has to happen. But I see that all the time. I mean, I think when I shared with you the story of our Burmese refugee who said, "Where's my computer?" It happened at the cultural orientation where they were told, forgive me for saying it this way, but this is kind of how I envision it. They're told that the U.S. has streets paved with gold. And they come here, and we do have to place. Well, I don't, because there's a Catholic Charities of the East Bay that would resettle refugees. They're going to place them in East Oakland because that's where the affordable housing is. In San Francisco, we would place them in the Bayview or the Tenderloin or the Mission. Well, not so much the Mission anymore, but the Bayview or Tenderloin, where there's housing. And the refugees will come back to our office and they'll say, "What are you doing? You're putting us in these dangerous neighborhoods." There was an article out of Atlanta that the Atlanta program was shut down by the Department of State for that reason, because they were placing refugees in extremely high crime neighborhoods. But I guess from my perspective, I'm saying, I know, but then if a landlord from Pacific Heights came and said, here's my whole building, put the refugees here, I would do it in a heartbeat, but that hasn't happened. And so I have to go where the housing is. Even just as I was coming here, I was driving past Benicia, and there was a time where she was a parishioner. She had an apartment building in Benicia. She was going to give me the apartment practically rent free, but it's Benicia. It's 45 miles away from San Francisco. I just didn't see how this family was going to thrive. Sure, they have a place to live, but then they were going to become in a sense imprisoned in that house. It was a beautiful apartment, but the commute was not going to work. And so these are the challenges that we face. And so that's why, it's not up here? Housing. Housing should be the number one. I don't know why I didn't put it in there, but housing is by far our greatest challenge in the Bay Area, finding adequate and affordable and safe housing for the refugees. But then these are the other challenges that they'll face. And so sometimes I feel powerless to address all of them. I can only address a handful of them. And so that's why I said I reach out to volunteers or other community groups or government agencies to fill in the void, but I don't think we'll ever reach all of it. It's a tremendous amount of acculturation and adjustment to a new life for people who've been living in a camp, or in the case of my Iraqi family, and I guess I'm running out of time, so I'm gonna start to close up. Just to share with you a little bit of the family from Iraq, they told me, the wife who invited me to their apartment in Daly City, and she fed me like you would not believe. I mean, the food I had, it was so delicious, and just it was like for a feast of many, and it was just for me. And I felt bad after my fourth plate. I said, I'm really full. But she was really generous and really giving. But then she started crying. She started crying because she said, "You've been so welcoming to us. You've been like our angel here. Thank you for that." And I said, "Well, tell me about you. I don't know anything about you. I just know I provided all these services and I know all the challenges you're facing, but I don't know anything about you." And then she started crying some more because she said, "Christopher, I was the queen of my house. That was my house. I had it was a four-bedroom house in Baghdad. My daughters were in school. My husband was working as a contractor for the U.S. government. We were living a good life. I always had high hopes for the future. And when we were given that note and told that, you have less than 4 hours to vacate your home, otherwise you're going to be killed, she left everything behind. She still remembers, her home. She remembers everything that she owned. And I know it's material. These are material possessions. But now they're, it's a family of four. They're living in a tiny little one-bedroom in Daly City paying $1,500 rent. And so she just couldn't get past that. Emotionally, she's a battered woman. She's feeling the trauma. And I've actually had to make sure that I send her to therapy because she is definitely suffering from PTSD. But not so much because of the war, because of the adjustment, because of leaving behind everything she knew and now coming to the U.S. and living how they're living. I mean, they're absolutely grateful of everything they've been given. That don't get me wrong. They're not unappreciative. But you know, at the same time, she is human, and she's mourning the loss of something that was hers. And how do we regain that? I had to break it to her and say, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's your husband right now is working. He's a limo driver. The daughters are, one graduated from high school with honors, and now she's off to UC Berkeley, actually. The other daughter didn't do too well. She was older when she came here, so it was a little harder adjustment, but she got married and now has a baby, and so now is living on her own. And I'm still trying to get mom to open up a catering business because I'm telling you, this woman can cook. That was amazing food. That might help empower her. That might help her see her dreams come true. And I told her, I said, you know what? But I know you had it back there. It's possible here. I didn't want to give her false hope, but at the same time, I wanted to encourage her that here you have an opportunity to start again. You may not get that four-bedroom house that you had in Baghdad, but you and your husband and now your daughter is going to college. And I said, you know, you still have me. I'm still going to be your angel, and I'm still going to be your friend and helping you along. You'll get there. You'll get there. Just give it time. They arrived in 2009, and next year they'll be eligible for citizenship, and so they'll be able to obtain the full rights of citizenship in the U.S. And they'll see their dreams come to life. They will, because I think that they have it inside them. But it really is hard to hear that and then see where they're living now, and you know, in their one bedroom apartment where the parents are sleeping on the couch because they gave their daughters the other bedroom, the one bedroom. So it's hard. It is hard. But let's see. I've got a little less than 5 minutes. Let's see if there was something I wanted to talk about. There's the event. This was a refugee awareness event in Oakland. I forgot exactly the name of the park. This happened last year. About, I think, 500 people attended. Just a good mix of refugees from all over the world and community members attended to just throw this big picnic to say welcome. You know, it was just a welcoming event. In San Francisco, we had one recently on June 20th, which was Refugee Awareness Day, at an organization's parking lot called Arriba Juntos. They threw a little picnic as well. We had a raffle. We gave out some gift cards, talent show, and they also brought food from their homelands. Again, just another welcoming opportunity for them. Let's see. Couldn't talk about this. This is kind of a lengthy presentation, and I do get long-winded. But okay, one thing I wanted to talk and end with. So as I said before, you know, I think we're all children in God's eyes, and our churches, I think I pretty much have tried to talk to as many people of different faiths as I could, are all in agreement that our churches do not have an immigration policy. We have a person policy. It's based on the human rights, human dignity, and the common good. Our churches look first at not whether somebody's legal or illegal, but human, but a human person in a human family. So in a sense, we all are part of the same human family. And so I really thank you for letting me be a part of your family this morning. And I have my card if any of you are interested in contacting me. And I really appreciate the chance to talk to you this morning. Thank you. Yeah.